Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. Joining, Aki is here and Horror Acolyte is here. How are you two doing?
Oh, just peachy.
Just peachy, huh?
Miserable.
Why are you miserable? Today is a beautiful day, Aki.
Actually, today is a pretty nice day. It's pretty cool outside, which makes me feel a little better about life. But I had blood drawn this morning, didn't sleep last night, and I didn't eat at all yesterday, so everything's just combining could not
blue,
be great.
All the leaves are green. The sun's as warm as a baked potato.
If it was that warm, I'd be even more miserable.
I think
miserable.
I know precisely what I mean when I say it's a shpadoinkle day, and I hope anyone out there gets that joke. I hope anyone gets that joke. We have two guests joining us from Sneg. We have Artem and Oleg. How are you two guys doing today?
Good, guys. Hey, everyone.
Welcome. Hi, everyone.
The show.
Someone sounds peachy.
For the people who don't know what Sneg is, who is or what is Sneg?
That's a good question, Artem. Do you want to start?
Yes, Sneg.
Go for it, and I will be interfering with you all the time.
Sure, please do. So, the word Sneg means snow, and it comes from a nostalgic place of missing a snow while living in Warsaw. We originally come from Moscow, Russia, and that place, usually at winter time, you get quite a few snow. And so for many, many years while living in Warsaw, Poland, it was snowless. And so it really boiled down to this feeling of nostalgia. And as we were searching for a name for the company, it had to be in some vicinity of the word nostalgia, because for obvious reasons, right, for working with classic games. And so it stuck. Also, the first company I worked at in the video games called Snowball. So it has some kind of, for me, historical context.
Very cool.
So you see, you already know the nostalgic factor there. But apart from it, I think Sneg, I think it's just like two of us generally. People that are coming and working in the games industry for a long time. We met at the moment. I was first working at GOG, Good Old Games, that I spent 13 years at.
Wow.
And Artem later on spent 8, because he was pitching one of the games that we wanted to bring on the service at the time. And you see, instead of bringing the game, he also brought himself to this company.
You hired me.
Yes, that's how it worked. And after times there, we decided that, hey, because the thing is that at the end we finished managing too many things, but we stopped doing things with our own hands. Like, I was co-managing the whole company. Artem was managing the GOG platform as such from the business perspective. Actually, what we loved doing, we loved always digging into old cases, trying to find homes, the rights for classics, solve the most complicated cases where the rights are split between multiple parties, and ensure that gamers can enjoy them again. Meaning working with developers, with community, ensuring that we fix that thing, fix this thing, and having this direct connection to games and gamers. And that's how partially Sneg was born.
Very cool. What are some of the games that you worked on over the years with GOG that made you want to go out on your own and dedicate a whole company to bringing releases back to the world?
It's hard to say, because within the first, I will say for myself, and then I'll pass the mic to Artem because he has a story. I'll just tell you that within the first 13 years of GOG, starting from the first year, 2008, I think I signed majority of these games because I was the first guy who was taking care of business development, and then I was the guy who was just signing agreements. So I love all of them. I know the story behind each of these games, including System Shock and others. So I cannot say that it was only one game that inspired us. I think all these games, generally, the preservation of these fantastic games, this is the one big inspiration.
I would also say that it's more about the games we were not able to bring on the platform. Those which were in some legal disarray, some state of uncertainty in terms of ownership, or some problems between the potential or possible IP owners, or just an absolute darkness in terms of who owns the rights, who might be owning parts of that. So that was always a very a major frustration. And it, from everything we do at GOG, that would be the most exciting part, where you really want to invest time, you really want to go into nitty-gritty details, like do the detective work, but you never have time for that because you have to manage things, you have to grow the platform, you need to release games, yada, 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 yada. And so it felt like we're not doing the coolest thing. And at some point we just decided that we really want to do it. But there's a funny story about it. Actually, my wife started the company first. She also works in the video games. And she was looking at me like, I want to do this classic things. I want to go into detective mode. And I never did it. And then in her maternity leave, she started the company during COVID. And she actually signed the first game. Said like, you know what? I'm just going to do the sidekick thing. I'm going to release the game. I'm going to do the remaster. Oh, I found the developer. He owns the rights. And she made me watch her doing this. And at some point, I was like, okay, I get it. And Oleg was like, yeah, let's do it. And we were like slowly banded together through that. And now here we are.
So how hard was it to get these games signed with you? Was it mostly pretty easy just talking to them, being like, hey, we'd like to bring your game back from, you know, the dead, basically? Or was it like hard to convince these people to let y'all publish it on Steam?
Are we talking about the Warhammer Classics thingy?
Warhammer, the Dungeons and Dragons games, any of them really, is
okay. Because I think each of them has its own story.
Aki's jumping ahead to present day. We were still talking about GOG, Aki.
I don't have the patience you do. How my brain works.
That's fair. She thinks in the.
I thought a question. I went with it. It is that's what it fair. Is.
I'm proud of you, Aki.
I think there are different stories behind almost each of them. So it's hard to say, hey, this is the general approach. You're coming to developer or you're coming to Games Workshop guys and everything is just sorted out. No, I think that if we're talking about purely Warhammer Classics, obviously we need to get in to get Games Workshop support here. Without them, nothing would be possible. And the great, talented, passionate people who know the legacy, who know the classics, who are gamers themselves. So we got incredible support from them and obviously green light to create this story. And then each particular developer, each particular game has something special. So for example, if we're talking about Space Hulk games, Space Hulk and Space Hulk Ascension, we had to talk to the CEO and founder of the original dev studio behind it, who closed his studio many, many years ago, and he's working at Scopely right now on a Star Trek game. And he said openly that, hey guys, I don't have anything. I just have good memories, great fun that we got back to the times, but the rest you need to sort out yourselves. So acquired the rights, he's part of the rights in these games, but the rest was solely on us, finding developers, reverse engineering things, putting them out of the shadow, unretiring them on Steam. So that's like the first story. But some games...
On the Space Hulk, sorry, printing. I think it was a pity that he deleted the source code from his archives like 2 years or something like that before we approached him. Oh, so for years it was a server, and then he deleted it, and then we came in.
Oh, wow.
Yes. That was a sad part of it. But again, we managed, and probably will be able to do even more at a certain point. With some games, indeed, we just had to have a green light from original developer, like in case of Fire Warrior, for example. And that's it. On some titles, we partnered with GOG because they own parts of the rights in some of the classic Warhammer games, like Final Liberation, Chaos Gate, Rites of War, and Shadow of the Horned Rat.
Didn't you sign them originally at GOG only?
Yes, because originally I've acquired it from one of the trusts that held those rights. So we partnered with them. But some games, we were working hand-in-hand with the original developer, let's say for the Man of War, Corsair. So original dev team was helping us to improve the game, fix more things, to ensure it returns in the best possible shape ever. With some games, we had to find two or three parties that were originally involved in the development and publishing of this game, ensuring that there are no conflicts, ensuring that everyone is fine with this release. And such games also appeared.
Hard to do, because I have heard so many horror stories of people going back and being like, okay, who owns this? And after like 100 hours, they're like, I still have no idea who actually owns this.
Have you seen the live action movie of Tetris? It's like a whole movie about that. It's kind of neat, but a little exaggerated.
If you go into helicopter view of the whole business, let's just call it this way, it's a lot of legal work. So in the course of working on many projects, we had to engage lawyers from across all kinds of jurisdictions and all kinds of countries and specialties, and they had to work on quite nuanced situations, and sometimes they can be resolved with one email. Sometimes it takes years to dig into the truth, and sometimes it's just a full stop because there's no traces of certain data, and then doing anything without that is just too risky.
I can give you the funny example. The deal that we, in order to bring one of the games that we didn't announce yet, we had to talk to one of the major publishers for 4 years, convincing and explaining that actually they have parts of the rights in one of the games. And they were always telling us, no, we don't have any rights in this. And we're just like, hey, guys, we know because we've seen the original agreement. So please sell us these rights. And they're like, hey, guys, we cannot sell you these rights. So we found a compromise. We found a solution how to make it all happen. But trust me, convincing people that they own the rights for certain things, it's also a challenge.
Jeez.
Wow, I would have thought it'd be harder the other direction. I would have thought more people would be like, I'm pretty sure we have the rights to that, and ends up not being the case, instead of people being like, we don't own any of that, and they actually do. That's hilarious.
Yeah, if you break it down, it's basically, hi, hello, do you know you own the rights? Can I pay you money? Like, no, thank you.
I'm sorry, I don't own any video game rights. What's that big folder that says video game rights I own? Oh, that. Oh, you know.
No, unfortunately, that's a sad part about the games industry, that for many years, especially 90s, beginning of the 2000s, nobody was tracking all these rights because it was all about retail. So you release the game, you put it on the shelves, players buy it, then they're getting out of the shelves, and it's done. In reality, you don't care about these rights anymore because in standard practices at the time, the life cycle was very short. Then with some companies appearing, trying to bring some back catalog titles back to the market, there was some hope that something will change. But at that time also, nobody thought that these games would be interesting for the crowd in 4 years, in 5 years. So the longevity was like 2-3 years max, and then the game was dying. And same for the rights of these games. Nobody cared about storing agreements, not even to mention source code and other things.
And you know, we're
right now with the digital era, it's different. But in the past, it was sad to look at it.
I was about to say that. Right now, we're saying this word rights. It's kind of an umbrella term. There are rights to the game, the right to publish the game, their trademarks. They're all can be split across different jurisdictions in different regions. There are actors, there's engines, middleware. All of that is a component. And you need to navigate all of this to get at least something released.
This seems to line up to what I've been told over the course of 13 years doing this show, and that is, quote, licensing is hard.
Yeah.
Well, look at all the games that got delisted. It's for, like, the music rights.
Yeah. Music like, rights, car rights, product rights. Seems like everything can cause a problem. Did you guys ever have a game where it was working perfectly, everything was lined up, everything looked good, it was... everything was like just perfect, and then the rights holder just like, nah, never mind, I don't want it, we're not releasing it, stop. Has that ever happened?
I'm just racing through my mind, give me a sec.
Throughout my 18 plus years dealing with the old games, yes, it did happen. If I'm talking about this happening at Snag, no, we're trying to cover ourselves from such cases.
That's good.
But it happens, and you don't know what's the reasoning. Sometimes just the management changes, and some people are scared to touch old IPs for some reason. Maybe there is an internal discussion that there might be a new iteration of the game in this IP. Or maybe somebody requested if there is an option to make a remake of that game. Most likely nothing will happen. But the rights owner might make a decision to withdraw from releasing it. Actually, and it's sad because in reality, if you bring back this game, this old IP, it can only help for remake. It can just reignite the interest in this game, which is strange. But people are strange. It's fine.
Since we're talking a lot about retro games and compatibility and keeping older titles alive, shifting topic a little, what are your thoughts on each of the three console makers and their works or attempts at backward compatibility and keeping their previous generations alive?
Archim, shoot.
It's a trap. They're all our partners. Okay,
fair.
Well, let's give credit, first of all, to them. Let's look at Nintendo and see their subscription model with their emulation work they're doing. And they're not ignoring their legacy. I think that's a good thing. You know, there's always an insane territory of what can be done extra. But let's also be true and face it that it's not the core of the business, right? It's not a major driving source of revenue. PlayStation with PS Classics, I think they can do better. And there's more that can be released, but I am beyond happy that it exists at all. Microsoft, you'll be surprised to notice that there are quite a few games which are not available anywhere else just because Microsoft has backward compatibility with original Xbox and Xbox 360. So I think it's something to celebrate, the fact that if somebody thought about this, and to this day we have quite some games which otherwise would be dead. So, like, we can all say that, you know, they're not doing enough, but then if you look specifically at the particulars of what they're doing, there's things that we can applaud them for.
I applaud Nintendo for continually putting out games, but I am not a fan of the subscription service. Xbox, I love what they did with the backward compatibility program. I don't think they ever should have ended the backward compatibility program. I think there's still a lot of life left in what titles they could do, even under their own first-party umbrellas right now, that they could still put out that wouldn't be as hard licensing-wise compared to, you know, the hundreds of other games they couldn't get working the first time around. Sony, I think, is an embarrassment what they're doing. They have such a huge history of games, and they drip feed one a month to their premium users, and that's gross.
You know, let's try to advocate for them for a little bit. Let's think of how much effort it requires to really release any classic game. It's actually not that straightforward. There's insane amount of technical work, and it's usually very custom per game. Even if you have an emulation engine, there's a lot of tuning that's required to make it work for your particular title. And it takes easily a decade to master the simulation tech. So it's like, it's such an investment from their side. And then at some point, someone financial or management or C-level looks into the cost of this, looks at their ROI. And then he looks at the people who are in the stock market, and then they're like demanding the growth. So they're naturally pushed into the direction of other things. And that creates an opportunity space. But strictly from the perspective of organization of this their size, it's really hard for them to justify putting a lot of effort into it. So yeah, the fact that they're doing anything is already a good thing.
I can be like a bit, I have a different view here. I agree with Artyom that it's a matter of priorities for these big companies. Unfortunately, that's the truth. But at the same time, I agree that they all can do more towards game preservation, backward compatibility, because there are gamers who actually require these services, who love the services. And if you, as a first party, don't have time for it, maybe contract somebody, find a partner who will be interested in taking care of this, who has passion for it. And this will just help each party to benefit. And I hope that this will happen one day, because we're all trying to ensure that everything is more efficient in our industry nowadays, with the crisis that we're going through. So maybe it will open a new opportunity. And let's hope it will happen, because I agree, significantly more things can and should be done in this field.
Yeah, I very much hope to see the backward compatibility programs expanded among all of the partners out there. Not just one. The more games from all of the companies that we get back from the history, the better, because that's a bigger library of classics that everybody gets to play.
I agree with you, and I believe that actually this should be the source of inspiration, because there are lots of gameplay mechanics, ideas that were forgotten, and with our industry tending to follow one trend or try to make games using the same template for years, we need innovation. And old games have lots of inspiration in them, and they can change our industry again. So more people play those games, more younger guys getting inspiration from them, better games we'll get.
Indeed.
I think we can all say that, agree that the problem is, pun intended, snowballing. The issue snowballs into bigger numbers. Yeah, but that creates an opportunity, as I already mentioned. So an opportunity means that somebody will take action, and it means that it's probably going to turn into something in a product and services or access into the games. Just think of it. How many games do you think were released in 1990? Like, just guess. I don't know
1990?
Myself.
1990? I'm going to guess like maybe? 60?
Maybe 60, maybe 500, maybe 1,000. Let's say 1,000. How many games were released in 2025?
Oh, Jesus. 200,000 million.
Yeah,
thousand,
exactly.
Trillion. Crazy bajillion.
Number. So the amount of games which managed to be released and die in between is just growing in a crazy volume. So it means that at some point, somebody will do something about it. Or people will start trying to create, as I mentioned, services, or try to bring them back. Or the opportunity will become so substantial that it will be unavoidable, and people will take action. Market will dictate itself.
So what is your goal directly with Snegg? Is it to focus mostly on PC games? Are you looking at retro console games, retro arcade games, Flash games? What branches are you trying to cover with what you're doing?
Artyom, feel free to start.
Sure. I think it will be fair to say that Purely egoistically, it's our own personal golden age of video games. So something we understand as the gamer. So mid to late 90s, early 2000s and forward, something we can talk for hours and hours because we played for a majority of them. We have a very good understanding of what was the landscape. So that's where we can truly bring the value. But largely, I think we would like to cover as many areas of video games because there is something very specific and unique about them. Like look into the games from the late 90s in different geographical parts of the world. Like you can distinctly say what is the British video game or what games with a French touch or games from more Eastern territories in Europe. They had their own particular flavor and that is worth preserving. And so it's really, I think, great if we can bring something like that back to the gamers. And there's no strong separation, be it consoles, be it PC, be it whatever, any other platforms, as long as we see that there is a cultural value which can be brought in economically sensible ways, like that's the opportunity we'll go for. But you should notice that we are not a museum, so we are not trying to go in that direction in terms of preserving. We picked intentionally a commercial way of exploiting classic video games, meaning that it has to make economic sense to bring them back. And I think market forces are a great way of preserving things because it's the best way to save something is to expose it to as many people as possible and make them play or enable them to play through their conscious choice.
I'll probably add that I think there is no restriction towards the games or the platforms that we want to bring back. Probably we're a bit egoistic here, so we're first trying to bring those games that we loved the most, that yep. we're the most passionate about. Yes, apologies for this. But there are no limitations. So there are certain console-only games that we would love to bring back. And we just had recently a long discussion about a few titles from early 2000s, and specifically one game that was like console exclusive. But I would love to play it on PC nowadays, or on consoles. There are many of those. And at the same time, even if the games existed on both, let's say PC or NES or Super Nintendo, so usually the console version at that time was better than the PC one. So why not bringing the console version back? Arcade, I think there are other studios that are working on this, and I think this is like a separate world on its own. So we'll allow it to other guys to tackle it, but whether it's PC or console titles, no matter which platform it was, definitely we're looking into those.
Very cool. What was it like releasing just about 20 games all at once? Just big dump of games, all on Steam, ready to go, including titles never on Steam before. How did that feel?
It felt like a nightmare for a while. No, that's true, because in reality, probably if you are a big publisher, big company, you have enough community managers, I don't know, developers to cover each part of the forum, each game that can work in parallel. In our case, especially with the games that were like first time launched on Steam or re-released on Steam after 10 plus years of being abandoned, it means that you need to prepare new assets for almost all of them. You need to prepare new builds for all of them. You need to ensure that at the moment you launch those, you have enough manpower to be present on all the forums, on each individual forum of the project, ensuring that you talk to community, you try to listen to community, you try to fix certain issues, because it's impossible to QA absolutely everything. There will be issues. We were lucky there were no crucial issues, but still there were certain issues that we had to fix, and certain partners of ours, a few developers, were working on a few titles, so they were almost torn between a few projects that they had to improve on the go, so it was challenging. But again, it's like it's a scale, and more people joining, more requests you get. So it's fun. Not to mention that releasing so many apps at the same time on Steam is also not trivial, because it's all about clicking lots of buttons. It's about ensuring that you have lots of things ready, approved, checked, and this operational work requires a lot of time and so on. But we managed to do this, so I think we're satisfied with the results. Hopefully gamers are as well.
Very good. I know it is exciting to see that many games out at once, and just, I need money.
We can share a few codes with you. Don't worry. We can save you a bit.
When something like that releases, as Oleg mentioned, it's inevitable that there are problems with the builds and the games. And despite all your best efforts, rigorous QA, there will be problems, because PC is just a zoo of all kinds of configurations. And at some point, inevitably appears a problem which is not 0.1% of the audience. It's more of like, okay, something was missed in some process of testing, and it's actually a real problem. So if that happens, then if you have a major success and everybody's playing it, it's like kind of, yeah. But on the other side, your support email becomes populated in real time, because that 1% starts to write to you in real time. So you're just having an avalanche of people coming to you with the same problem, and you need to find a system or ways to manage that. And you cannot just say, oh, what? I'm not going to reply until I get fixed. No, you actually need to reply to all of them. And so multiply it by 10, you get a certain scale where you need to expect a potential problem. So it is an operation to release 10 games. You need to prepare for that. And it can be very exhausting.
So looking through your game library, there's one that caught my eye that I have had an interest in for quite some time now, and that goes by Captain Blood.
Oh, this, I was supposed to ask about that.
this was, what, an old 360 game that just kind of fell apart and then you guys brought back to life?
Yeah, that's kind of it. So both Oleg and myself had some affiliation with this game, Oleg more so, me less. So I'll let him talk more about it.
Back to me just starting the games industry, again, back to my time in Russia, I was working with a developer and publisher called Akella, that actually was the original developer behind this game. And despite the fact I was working in international licensing, the dev team was sitting in the same open space as we did. So for 2 years, I was observing what exactly they're doing. I was observing different international publishers coming and looking at this game, from Atari to Vivendi at the time and others. And the game was changing its direction so many times based on the feedback of the big guys, that at the end, when it finished with the God of War inspiration in the pirate theme, I think everyone was super happy that finally there is something. But then, unfortunately, and again, it was already without me being there, the game finished in limbo, because there was a big Western publisher who got the rights to publish this game on PC and consoles worldwide. But unfortunately, this publisher got bankrupt. And despite developers' efforts, and the game already went through pre-cert, so it was really close. But when developers tried to get back the rights, it also got stuck in limbo in court proceedings, because there were quite a few companies that wanted to get assets and money out of there. So the case was sorted out like years and years after, but at the moment it got sorted out, so there was already another generation of consoles, there was no development team. So it just died out. So the rights were still with developer, but nobody wanted to touch it. And at certain points, I think we saw that probably somebody from the original team, most likely, we don't know, put part of the source code to internet. And a few guys managed to compile it, and they started streaming it. So that's the moment when Artem caught it, and he told me, "Oh, like, do we want to take care of this game?" And it was an easy yes from my side. So, because again, there is so much nostalgic feel towards this game, and we're still talking to many to original developers that work in different parts of the world. Lots of them moved to US, lots of them moved to Canada, and we asked them, "Hey guys, what do you think about it?" And we immediately created Discord channel with I think with 18 guys from the original team being there supporting, giving hints, insights, sharing memories, and that's how the project was kicked off.
Very cool.
I observed it from another angle. I was working on the publisher's end for this game, and I remember distinctively going to Gamescoms year after year, and we're like, showcasing Captain Blood. Okay, fine. So we're releasing it soon. Yeah, sure. Okay, great. Next year. So we're still showcasing this game. Yeah, it's coming out soon. And then suddenly it just disappears. So it was kind of an upsetting thing, because back then it looked like a very promising game. In the to the Discord part, which Oleg mentioned, you should also understand, like, these developers, they spent years and years working on this game. And then they never saw the launch or any success or failure for this title. And so it builds a certain disappointment that you, like, wasted your time on this. So for them, it was very important to close the story and to release it. And it, as we jumped into this Discord, it became very clear that we actually doing something very important for them. And it kind of raised the bar in terms of what we should do.
Well, I want to thank you guys for getting Captain Blood out, because that's something that's been on my radar for a while. And now that I finally got to talk to you guys, I have no excuse to not pick it up. So
you can check it out, because another fun story that the guy who was the project lead on it actually is like one of the senior tech directors of Roblox. And he has lots of memories about the game.
And I love that it's on Xbox. We are Xbox fans on this show, so the more games that show up on Xbox, the happier for us. Are any of your other titles in works for console, or are you guys focused mostly on PC?
Yes, there are a few titles that are in works for consoles. That's something that is being cooked.
Anything you can tease?
I don't know. Archie, do you want to tease something?
Well, I think there is infinite space of opportunity for releasing all kinds of Dungeons & Dragons games and consoles. I think if we will have an opportunity to do so, we will definitely do so.
Very good.
It was a tease.
It's a good tease. We like D&D. Horacolyte, do you have any other questions you want to ask?
Yeah, I have a couple, actually.
Go for it.
So I know during the 2000s, around that era, there was like tons of games that were kind of like Captain Blood that went into like development limbo for like various reasons. A bunch of them that were like in the 90% to almost even 100%, probably some even at the 100% complete range, but just never made it to market. Are you guys like kind of pursuing like those types of games as well? And if not, like I assume the ones at like 90%, like I wouldn't want to try and finish them, but maybe the ones that are closer to like the finish side of things.
If you can share the names of these games, we'll be able to tell you something about it, probably.
I can't think of any in particular.
California Raisins on the NES.
I know I have a buddy who is like pretty big into like retro, like obscure games that kind of faded off the radars, ones that have been published in like magazines and talked about, but he was more of a fan of those than I was, or more knowledgeable, I should say. But I know he always talked to me about them, and that's the only reason.
If you have some of the names, just feel free to share those with us, because again, I think it's not a secret that obviously after having the story with Captain Blood, we were looking in many of those. We were talking to quite a few original developers of the games that you're probably having in mind from that specific era that were closed by big publishers for some unknown reasons. But so far, I cannot say that we are working on any of those, because usually it's super complicated, because majority of the rights for these games finished with big guys that don't care about this nowadays. We tried a few things. We failed, at least for now, but never say never.
Yeah, our efforts are kind of, it's endurance race. So they say no today, or fine, let's talk in a year, in two, in 5 years. And you'll be surprised that the majority of time the opportunity is close, but then once in a while, there's a short, very brief moment of opportunity which you need to jump in, and then actually things can happen. But I think the holy grail of what you just mentioned probably StarCraft Ghost. Like this one was legendary in terms of being, we're going to ship it, and then not shipping it.
Oh, that so
I think everybody
still.
Would be very happy if somebody will finish it.
Yeah.
What about something like True Fantasy Live Online for the original Xbox that Level 5 was working on?
Yeah, that one. Or remember, famously announced Star Wars 1313 or Prey 2. There's like a long list of things.
I know one for me recently that kind of got spoiled online was like the original build for like Duke Nukem Forever, when it was like way back in the day. That looked like it could have been really cool, the earlier builds.
Tiberium Shooter, anyone?
That one I don't recognize.
So yeah, it's like a long list. You know, if you look into the subsets in the groups of games within the industry, actually, games that worship is a small minority of all projects ever conceived. Many die on the alpha stage, some die at the beta, but there's quite a few games which were killed unrightly right before they were supposed to be released. For no good reason. It had nothing to do with the game being good or bad.
Yeah, I know my buddy was telling me about one that like they just want to pay for like the manufacturing costs for like N64 cartridges like back in the day. It was, like the game was like 100% done. I don't recall what the name of it was, but like hearing that type of stories is depressing. Like at that point,
well, that's a shame. That's a shame.
Aki, what about you? Any questions on your end?
Nope, my brain's turned to mush now.
That is nothing new.
Nope, not at all.
Artem Oleg, we've been chatting for a while. Is there anything you guys wanted to bring up that we didn't ask?
A quiz for you. What do you think happens with the IP rights for a video game if for some reason during closure of the British video game company, it stays in the video game company? Who owns it?
I would imagine the original IP owner still owns it, don't they?
No, wrong.
No?
I mean, it probably depends on how the studio was closed, wouldn't it? Because like they would probably have to sell off a bunch of stuff if they owed debt.
We didn't sell it. Someone would buy it. First reason states with legal entity. The king of the United Kingdom.
What? Huh.
The crown, yes. Yes.
That is weird. So have you had to directly contact King Charles and be like, hey, can we get the rights to this game?
He has a legal department for these kind of things, but it's possible, yeah. And I'm just saying that there's quite a few weird things you would not imagine how things are working, and they are actually working that way. So that's just one example to entertain.
Yeah, I think that's apart from it, no, guys, I think we had a nice discussion and lovely chat with you. And thanks a lot for inviting us.
I thank you both very much for making the time to come on and chat with us. How can people keep up to date with you guys and what you're doing?
I think that's something that we need to work more on. It. I think you can follow us on the... Yes, yeah, that's true. We're so much passionate about video games that for many, many years we're ignoring the fact that we don't have a website or social media channels. I think the best way to do is to follow us directly on X, on LinkedIn. We're trying to drop more updates there. And hopefully within a few months we'll finally kick off our social media channels.
Very good. We will keep an eye for those. Yeah, social media is annoying, but you got to deal with it.
Yes, that's true.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, again, I want to thank you two for coming on, hanging out with us, chatting with us. Everyone, stick around. We are going to take a quick break. We will be back with more show because we got reviews to take care of. Yay! Artem and Oleg, once again, it has been a pleasure. Do either of you have any final words to end the interview?
Just thank you guys for having us. It was a pleasure to talk to such passionate people. And thank you for your listeners, for their time.
Thank you for your time. And for the listeners, I'd say keep playing video games you like. And if some video game you like is not available, be vocal about it. Because people listen, watch, and if you mention in volume that you really want some game back, that matters. That's important.
Guitaru Man for the PS2.
Note it.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. Another huge thanks to Oleg and Artem at Sneg for coming on and hanging out with us. Aki, that was a fun time, wasn't it?
Yep.
And we got to learn what Sneg means.
Yep.
Do you realize
that? I was not expecting snow.
And do you know why we know that? Because they were good informers. Yeah, I went there.
As one should. It was an informer.
What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it, Aki?
I'm sorry. I've barely been paying attention. What?
God damn it. Aki's here. Pernell's here. And we have our good friend Melody Shu joining us. Melody, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm pumped to have you on the show. We have been friends for, 20 years?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Oh my god, we're getting old.
Classic friend. Old 1UP Studios veterans.
Hell yeah, dating back to the barbecues.
Yep.
They're good days. Good days. So what have you been up to? What is going on in the world of Melody?
Not a whole lot, but I just got back from a company dinner is where I was just now. I finished a big project, so they gave us free food and booze, so that was nice.
Hell yeah. Did you get drunk?
Only a little bit.
Enough to be on the show.
Enough to be on the show, that's right.
Oh, get another bottle. Finish the job on the show.
I don't know if I actually... Oh, wait. Yeah, I might have something stashed away, but... I'll leave that for a special occasion.
Aki likes when she gets to get fucked up on the show.
It don't happen too often.
I mean, you could literally do it anytime you want.
Well, yeah, that's because I literally always have booze, but I'm not particularly interested in that. I have to have a good reason. That reason is just about any reason, but still, it has to be a good one.
D's here. There's your reason.
There you go.
No, fair enough. I'll be right back.
For now, you want to grab a drink while you're at it?
Sure, I guess. I will. Yes, I will. About doing it. Shit.
Everyone's grabbing drinks, and I'm grabbing me one of my Mountain Dew Supernovas. I'm so happy I have these things. Oh, my God.
You should be conserving those things.
Wait, so like what is the flavor? What is, how does the supernova taste? I have to know.
Delicious. It is strawberry melon.
Strawberry melon. Okay.
Yes. It was okay. One of the first three Democracy flavors, along with, I think it was Typhoon or Distortion, one of those, and Voltage, which is the one that won, which is stupid.
Bullshit.
And it shouldn't have won because it's stupid and dumb and stupid.
It's and, good, but there's no supernova.
They've brought it back like two times since then. One in a let's have a do-over, which it won, but it didn't win somehow, and they put Pitch Black on shelves, and then they took Pitch Black off shelves, so like nothing happened. I don't know. I don't get it. But it hasn't been in America in 15 years, and damn. Canada has it. So I imported a 24-pack from Canada.
Nice.
And it tastes glorious.
Yeah, because I remember there was a, what was it, like a black hole or space Oreo or something. And I was like, what does that even taste like?
Like when Coke did all their flavors, like Millennium. What does Millennium taste like?
Millennium.
I don't know if it was Willennium.
No.
I assume it would taste like semen.
Oh, God.
That's Aki.
That's our Aki.
I do know there's like, aren't there like pickle Oreos now?
What?
I hope the fuck no. Not.
If there were, I would know, and I'd have eaten some by now, because that sounds intriguing. But no!
That is awful.
There should be pickle Oreos, even as a April Fool's cookie.
Mm.
I know for a fact because one of my friends tried them. I think it was. I think it was for April Fools.
I gotta Google this right now. Pickle Oreos, dill pickle flavored fudge. Oh my God! How did I not know about this? You can buy them still.
Go ahead.
They can be bought. I might have to do it.
Do it.
Shit. Look what you did! Look what you did to me.
What are they on Amazon?
No, on Oreo.com.
Oh, on Oreo.com. You're going straight to the source.
Dill pickle flavored fudge. Holy shit.
Can I just ask a quick question in what the fuck is wrong with you?
I must have them. I have to try. I have to know what pickle fudge tastes like.
The now, answer the Smoreo, is more than anyone could ever know.
The Smoreo cookies, those look good.
Fair. Nah, they're normal. That's nothing special. How many times have you been like, we put marshmallow and chocolate in a cookie? Hey, fuck that. This is pickles. All right. Nah, I'm doing it. And now, apparently they also have, though these are expensive, Oreoid Disney Princess Snow White cookies.
Huh.
Huh. This is some dangerous shit. But this is... All this is a cook gift box includes 6 fudge dip Oreo cookies covered in sprinkles. So that's basically like an artsy piece. They've done sprinkle cookies before. That's nothing new. And they're charging you $30 to get your hands on those. The dill pickle cookies are only $10, which is still a rip up. But there's also apparently a 6 pack. So maybe it's 6 different cookies. No, it's 6 single cookies in the box. Still, curiosity is going to win. I know I just met you and this is crazy, but you like crazy cookie flavors and I appreciate it, so thank you.
You're welcome.
See, this, Joe, is the worst, like, this is the worst transaction that has ever happened on this show.
Nope.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I err on the side of curiosity and it almost always wins. Thankfully, I'm not a cat or you'd have to find another co-host.
All right, people in chat can see exactly what we're talking about right now because it's on screen.
Yeah,
Oreo, dill pickle flavored fudge cookies.
Yes! They might be the nastiest thing, and I don't even care. I just have to know. I have to know firsthand if they're decent or not. They won't but I have to know.
Shit like this is how you know people don't think of should consequences this in life? Exist. They just think
consequences
can
in
exist.
Life. That's what they don't think about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. If this were data center flavored Oreos, I'd be right on board with you. I don't need that in my life. But this is dill pickle. I can deal with it. This is a data center Oreos. So I can work with this a little bit. Have some fun with some craziness.
It is horrifying.
That is horrifyingly a base awesome. Of perfectly good $10, but whatever.
All right, hey, like, this is Jones what happens when humanity goes unchecked. Yes, yes, it is.
No. Humanity going unchecked is how we got the Jones's Holiday Sodas. Okay, that's the real answer there.
Okay,
are you familiar with those?
The Thanksgiving ones.
Yeah, those were a rightful abomination, and I drank them like four times. They're disgusting. But the thing is,
drink enough of the shit.
I am a soda addict, and I have never tried those because I have sense.
No, it's a bonding
moment.
I've never
even heard of it.
Yeah, I've never heard of the Jones Soda holiday flavors.
No.
Oh my! Do you know what Jones Soda is?
No.
Jones Soda is a brand of real sugar, made in glass bottles, usually sold in a 4-pack. Have great flavors like cola, bubble gum, shit like that.
Peach a la mode.
Okay, interesting. Never heard of any
and
of that.
They do a lot of weird food flavors, and they will do turkey and stuffing, and they will do sweet potato.
Mashed potatoes. Wait, I guess they did do sweet potato. Mashed potatoes and gravy, fruit pie, turkey stuffing, green bean casserole. Remember being one?
Okay, yeah, I understand the fruit pie because that's just fruit and sugar. Fine, whatever. That's, you know, 90% of what a soda is anyways. But the rest of that sounds fucking horrific.
As it was meant to. It was Thanksgiving dinner, and then they did another one for Christmas dinner, and then they did a much safer one for Valentine's Day, and it was like the love potions or whatever. But they were disgusting, except for the fruit one. But I still drank them to an extent. I didn't drink the whole bottles. At one point, my friend took the bottles away and started pouring them down. She's like, you can't do that. I got to drink those. She's like, why? Like, they cost money. And she's like, these weren't fit for human consumption. I won't let you.
You heard Bree tell her story about when she did flavored sodas on stream, right?
No.
Oh, Bree, where are you? We need you. If you're hanging out on Twitch, jump in here and tell us about it. But
you got to tell us third party. That way you can get all the details wrong and it becomes a whole new legend.
Yeah, the quick summary basically is sodas. She got like a 12-pack variety flavors of fucked up soda flavors, and she would, anytime someone like donated a certain amount of bits or subbed or whatever it was, she would roll a random number and she would drink or chug based on the donation from that bottle.
Oh.
Yeah. And there was pickle flavored soda.
Or was it just like but honestly, pickle flavor is doable. I've had pickle soda before. There was a place in Long Beach, California, when I went there to visit a friend that had like maple bacon soda and all kinds of weird mess like that.
I mean this in the nicest way possible. What the fuck is wrong with you?
I'm your friend. That's what's wrong with me.
I mean, no, that just that doesn't explain what's wrong with you. That just explains why you're my friend. There's something fucking wrong with you. That's why you're my friend.
Yeah, here's the pack. Here's some of the ones that may have been flavors. They had buffalo wings, sweet corn, ranch dressing, peanut butter and jelly, black olive, enchilada, pickle, horchata.
I'm wondering if that's the same brand.
That all, like, some of those sound like they wouldn't make it's good drinks, but Lester's. Man, I'd like to eat it, but fucking
I think a peanut butter soda could legitimately work if it's done right. That's the important part. It had to be done right, but I bet it can work.
You know what? I'm not shocked that there's a ranch one out there, because I've seen people drink ranch like it's a fucking soda. So, fair, there's something wrong with those people, but those people do exist for reasons.
Hey, Pernell, Horror Acolyte wants to know if you're getting the World of Horror board game.
I want to. I definitely want to. Ask him. Well, he can fucking hear me. Is it in late pledge? Because I don't, if our last I remember, it was on Kickstarter as a pledge.
I mean, if he wanted, he could just jump in here and talk directly about this.
True, but he's also an attendee in the chat, so it's like he's helping out every which way. Indeed. But I definitely need his input on the World of Horror game because I am genuinely interested in it.
Lost and Cult.
Oh, so it's not a Kickstarter thing. You can just grab it now.
And look up.
I'm going to look it up now.
What's that about, Pernell? Tell us about it.
Well, you've played the World of Horror video game, right?
Nope.
Oh, so it's basically like, it's kind of similar to like a PC-98 RPG, all black and white, and it involves you playing through a series of Lovecraftian horror-esque narratives.
Ooh. That sounds nice.
It's a cool game.
Looks very interesting.
What are they charging for? That's the concern.
$500.
Single player card based survival RPG. Deluxe. It hurts that it's a single. Oh, damn. That ain't cheap.
Standard is £60. Deluxe is $109.
Gotta be deluxe. I can't do standard.
And there's not the deluxe this. Neo 80s box palette variant, where it comes in a purple box.
I got to figure out what the deluxe edition has that's different. That's the key. Softcover rule book has been transformed to a matte black. Ooh, 3-panel folding game. Fuck me. I'm going to have to do it. I'm not big on the whole single player RP on board games because of the fact that usually my single player time is spent on a video game instead of a board game, but I've made a few exceptions here and there. This is very possible.
Did you see that there are more variants?
Yeah, I saw that. I just came from the website. I went in and looked it up.
I wonder what that IGN one is about, because that's only 300. And then the
IGN
Guerrilla Edition, 249. That is ridiculous. I was going to say,
the joke is that their edition is too much water. There's a bunch of water on the cover. For those who get that reference. But yeah, I'm gonna have to do it. I'm also considering the Vampire Survivors video game a board game too.
That's weird that's a board game, but they have a new game out too.
Oh, you know I bought that today.
I didn't come play on. It yet.
Neither did I. I mean, no, it's been a busy day, but Vampire Survivors already showed me that they can do damn near no wrong. And early dialogue about the game was already pretty much saying that. People were saying they think this is better than Vampire Survivors. Like, oh, that's an interesting statement to make. So I'll give it a try. Hopefully it is delicious.
You'll have to let us know. But there are some games we got to talk about on this episode. Should we get to these?
Is any of them Vampire or, Vampire Survivors or Vampire Crawlers? Well, I don't want to do it.
Well, tough shit. What do you think about that? Tough shit.
Yeah, Adol would want it this way, so that was fine.
Everyone ready to get to reviews?
Sure.
Let's do it.
All right, first game to talk about tonight, E's Memoir, Revelations in Celceta. Developed by Nihon Falcom, published by XSEED Marvelous USA. It's releasing April 28th on the Switch for $29.99. Explore and map out your way across a dangerous landscape, taking advantage of a unique tag team party combat system that allows for creativity and strategy. Seek the truth of Adol's past against the musical backdrop of a refreshed soundtrack. Reawaken the spirit of adventure exclusively on the Switch in East Memoir, Revelations in Celceta. Pernell, what is going on in East Memoir?
Okay, so E's Memoir, let me get this out the way immediately for folks who are like me. We're like, ooh, new E's game. This is not a new E's game. If you are familiar with the franchise, E's Memoir, Memories of Celceta, is actually another edition of E's Memories of in Celceta, which was released on the Vita, and then later, I believe, on PlayStation 4. And those games themselves were re-envisionings of both versions of E's 4 that came out back in the 90s. So this is another iteration of that. I'm going to start off the top for folks who are like, I know those games. What's different about this? The only thing different about this game It's basically the PS4 version, but they added a new soundtrack version in the form of the Memoirs version. And as far as that soundtrack goes, I'll be blunt. It's okay, but it ain't beating the original. There's been a big back and forth.
I just want to say a quick thank you because I looked over to my other monitor so I could look at the game information. I just saw Fudge Pickles. So, Pickle Fudge.
And it what?
Fudge Pickle. Oh, Pickle Fudge.
Oh. Pickle Fudge.
Pickle Fudge. Pickle Cookies. So, yeah, that's still on my computer. I got to get rid of that.
No, you need to order a pack.
Nope. S'mores.
But, yeah, so, like, there's been a raging debate back and forth on whether, you know, the classic Ease composer or the current Ease composer, the superior bet. It depends on who you talk to who wins. But I'll say, personally, in this case, it's definitely the classic. And classic being, you know, Ease Vita, PS Vita. Anyway, for those who don't know what this game is, it's basically another chapter in the Adol Christian adventure chronicle, you know, biography or whatnot that you get to play through, where he goes on various adventures throughout the course of his life and he writes about them in his journals. In the case of this one, this is one of his earlier adventures where he goes to explore an adventure through the mysterious force of Celceta. It's a massive force. But the beginning of this game, it turns out he's already been through the forest, but for whatever reason, he can't remember because he wakes up in the middle of a town with amnesia. Tell me if you heard that one before.
That sounds like a role-playing game.
Yes, right. And I bet there's a big bad who's going to destroy the world waiting at the end, too.
Probably.
Ultimately, he stumbles into a bar. He bumps into a person who says they know him and they wonder what he's doing there. And without going down the rabbit hole, let's just say the crisis occurs in town. The spirit of adventure, you know, unlocks within him. He goes about his business and then he gets tasked with exploring the great force of Celceta for a benefactor who runs the town for great rewards if he manages to do so. And that's pretty much what kicks his adventure off. Gameplay in this game revolves around using the earlier mentioned unique tag team system, which is really not that unique because it's been an Ease staple for a while now, but you can control up to 3 characters at a time, along with up to 3 characters in your reserve that you can pull whenever you want. And these characters have a basic attack, and they have up to 4 equipable special attacks that can be associated with them. Those characters that you are not controlling at any given time in your party of 3 can, if you choose, fight on their own and support you in combat, or they can idle and stand by while you do all the work. I can advise you, if you're interested in keeping your characters leveled up together, I'd advise you not to let them sit idle while you do all the fighting. I'll tell you why shortly, or rather you'll notice shortly. You also get those special attacks I mentioned. 4 special attacks equipped at any given time associated with the face buttons. You can use them as long as you have the spirit energy to do so. Spirit energy is earned by beating the stuffing out of monsters, which is kind of cool because it's one of those games where you have to constantly pop MP potions. You just beat stuff up and get magic. It's great like that. You also get access to super abilities where once you max another gauge, which is also filled up by beating the stuffing out of things, you can press L and R together to do, like, for instance, a screen clearing mega attack. And due to the fact that it's not too hard to refill that gauge, you may find yourself using it frequently also. It's not something you hold on to. It's something you burn when you get it, baby. You get to equip yourself with various equipment items, weapon, shield, and 2 accessories per character. And as you play throughout the game, you'll get access to just like components that you can find by breaking, you know, rocks or slashing grass that can be used to upgrade your equipment. And it's never really so much that it's going to make or break your experience playing the game. You'll likely end up finding equipment later that's just outclassed to whatever upgraded piece of equipment you've been putting your resources into. But it's still a nice thing to do for incremental gains and buffs for or against various elements. As you're walking around, each character also gets their own unique. Like field ability. For example, Adol's isn't really so much an ability as just a thing he does where as you explore, you'll come across orbs that represent lost memories of his that if you walk up to them and press a button, you'll get a flashback for them, and you'll also get a stat bump by doing so. Other characters might have other things like picking locks or hitting faraway switches. You know the typical tropes. You've been there before. But anyway, they're still fun to use, The characters are extremely fun to control, and the music, the regular music anyway, is fantastic. Still one of my favorite modern Eve OSTs, especially Gust of Wind. And I think you'll be happy to give it a listen if you've never heard it before, and repeat players, if they want to get an updated version from the Vita and they skip the PS4 one, I think this is a great place to get in on that. I also realized I didn't even mention the whole thing about why you should let your characters fight. Let's fix that right now. I mentioned earlier about the four abilities that you can equip. Those abilities actually level up and get stronger as you use them repeatedly. The last thing you want to do is have your main character that you use all the time get their things bumped up and the other characters languish with their weak, baby-fied smackdown attacks. So you want to make sure that everybody's spreading the wealth evenly and getting gains as they can. The story, I feel, in this game is probably one of the weaker ones of the bunch, because while I'll admit that it gets a fair bit better towards the end of the game, maybe the last, two-fifths of the game is awesome from a narrative perspective, most of the game is pretty much you walking around being like, oh, wow, you've been here before, Ado. You don't remember? No. Okay, well, let's go to this dungeon and beat these things up, I guess. that happens frequently. So you're not really getting much of the grand narrative or what actually happened to Adol for the most part until that last two-fifths of the game. But I do feel like that last part of the game, the narrative is pretty awesome. I did enjoy experiencing where it went in the ultimate conclusion of the game. But for most of the game, I just enjoy beating the crap out of things and mapping out Celceta, because I should mention that too before I wrap this review up, is that one of the overarching quests that the game has is the thing I mentioned at the very beginning, which is you are commissioned to explore the ruins of the forest of Celceta and all that exists within it. And the more you map out the said areas and then take them back to the starting town of the game, the more rewards you will gain for doing so. In other words, it is in your best interest to explore every nook and cranny of the map that you can, which is something that I like doing for free, let alone when I'm getting paid to do it. So, I mean, if you're the type of person that likes filling in a map, well, this is the game for you there too. All in all, I would say if you already own memories of Celceta in any of its forms, except for maybe the Vita, I'd say you don't really need this one because the new OST isn't anything special and you've already experienced the game proper before. However, if you've never played this game or if it's been way back since the Vita days that you've played it and you'd like to play it again on something, visually more impressive with a larger screen, well, I think this is a good buy for you. So I think ultimately my review is going to be with the part where you say, hey, Purnell, what do you think?
Hey, Purnell, what do you think?
I think if this game, I'm going to give it a default buy it with the caveat that if you've already played it on like the PS4 or whatever, and you're wondering, is this the reason to get it? Then I would say, no, don't bother. But otherwise, this is an easy buy it recommendation. Ease games are generally great, and this one's no exception to that rule.
Got to give them credit that they're still finding ways to release this game.
It would be nice if they would just go back and release the original one for PC Engine and Super Nintendo. We never got those over here.
Or if they brought this to, Xbox and PlayStation. Well, it's already on PlayStation. Bring it to the last place it needs to be. Bitches. Next up, Arcadia Fallen, developed and published by Galdra Studios. It released April 9th as an Xbox Play Anywhere title, Switch, PS4, PS5. And PC for $29.99. 7 years after the dramatic events of Word Valley, the political situation surrounding magic has reached boiling points within the Empire. At the Seven Winds Academy, however, life goes on undisturbed by outside influences. Here, the students' biggest worries are exams, job prospects, and who might be taking whom to the New Year's gala. But when a curious group of seniors stumble upon a hidden secret within the castle, their priorities for the year change in an instant. Aki, what is Arcadia Fallen 2?
Okay, so in this, you get to make your own character, and you get to choose a route that your character is going to take. Yay! This is mostly a visual novel, so you do have choices in it. You're basically going to be choosing what life path your character has. So in this, it's basically your schooling. So because you're at school, you get a choice between
basically three majors. There are four in the game, but they don't let you choose the actual interesting one, at least as far as I'm concerned. The four of them are the naturalist, which is the one you can't choose, which allows you basically to talk to plants and helps you grow plants and shit. One of them is the tinkerer, which is the one I chose. Basically, you're creating magical items. Then there's the illusionist, which are basically bards from any video game you've ever played. And then the last one is menders, which are basically your healers. They use the plants from the naturalists to create different salves and shit, and then also use magic to heal people to some degree. And yeah, so you're playing as one of a group of mages that are at the school. You're forced to be here from childhood because it's dangerous to let mages just walk about because they could accidentally hurt people with their magic. This game has some strong points and it has some very serious weak points. The strong points are basically all the character interactions. They're rather amusing because all of the main characters of this game are vastly different from each other. You got Puck, who is a
dick
lazy
on the real
shit.
World.
What?
Puck, he was a dick on the real world.
Oh, wow. That's okay then.
I'm a 90s kid.
Yeah. Say Jesus, that's a blast from the past that I barely remember at this point.
Poor Pig.
I barely saw that. Puck is a young woman who is basically the college's delinquent. She's very much, I will do the bare minimum to pass and nothing else. I will skip every class, every assignment I can. I will only do what is absolutely required to get a grade that isn't a failure. Because I'd rather spend all my time building this giant machine, because she's also a tinkerer. And what they do is they're trying to build machines that no one's ever seen before to leave their mark on history, basically. And she's trying to create a giant flying boat, basically. And then you get a naturalist on your side who's named Kim, and he's just this very shy, soft-spoken dude who's like, I want to do good at school, I'm not going to cheat, and everyone basically picks on me. very sweet boy. Absolutely useless. You then also, as the game continues, you actually get introduced to some other characters who are part of your party. A prefect, which for those of you who haven't watched Harry Potter, that's basically the top student is a prefect. So the goody two shoes, the, you know, class president type, if you will. She's also, you know, kind of what you'd expect. She's shy. She wears glasses. She tries to follow the rules. Is also picked on a lot. And then there's, Idris? Elris? Something like that. I've barely interacted with him, sadly. And he's basically the school's heartthrob. He's a mender, and everyone's like, oh, he's just a sexy big man. So they all interact with each other, obviously, in the scenes as you're playing through the game, but also when you're in the map HUD, where you can travel around to different places in the school and interact with different people, they'll also interact with each other, which is really funny. But all of you are basically getting together to deal with some of the secrets in the school. There's a quote-unquote dragon that is living in the school that no one knows of but your little group, and they are trying to find some special items to hopefully find the rest of their kind that are hidden from the world, supposedly, even though it looks kind of like a cat-rat thing. It doesn't look at all like a dragon. Throughout doing this, you're also dealing with other issues in the school, and this is where the writing kind of goes downhill a lot. For instance, there's three types of people in this world. There's people who can't use magic, there's mages, and then there's outlanders. The difference between normal people and mages can use magic, and they're brought to the school from a young age because they can use it from birth. Would you like to know the difference between a mage and an outlander? Outlanders can use magic from birth. Mages can't.
Okay.
Exactly. The key problem is the difference between group A and B is the same fucking thing as the difference between group B and C. You can't do that. That doesn't work. And, you know, like, every couple of chapters in the game, there's a new issue that you're all dealing with. The first chapter, you're basically dealing with, for some reason in this universe, you have four different ranks for mages. A, B, C, and gone, basically. And at this school, if you get bumped down to D rank, you get moved to the productivity facility, and you're never heard from ever the fuck again.
Oh, period. Cute.
Yeah, yeah. And it turns out that the teacher that you and some of the other students have as an elective, the headmaster has decided with her that there needs to be a bunch of students that fail this year because too many passed last year. So they have to look good by failing a bunch of people because apparently that's somehow going to make this school look good. So they've decided to create an exam for this class that no one can pass because it isn't on anything you've covered. And you deal with that in chapter one. I'm more than halfway through the game. Wanna know how many times it's been brought up since chapter one?
Zero.
Exactly. Would you like to know what would happen if I was in that school? That teacher would be dead, because they're trying to fail people so they get moved to the place where people are never fucking heard from again. No. No. You're trying to kill me.
Are you saying you're gonna murder them?
Oh yeah, I would. 100%. Because they're trying to kill me and disappear me. Mm-mm. No. They're dead. And I would be spreading that to the entire school. And those teachers would just be gone. And yeah, it's constantly little issues like that where it's like, if you just told people about this shit, it would solve a lot of problems real quick. Because once you deal with this, then somebody comes in who is clearly a bad guy, who opens their mouth and everything they say is clearly just some shady shit, trying to deal with the superpower under the school's, basically. It's like an item of infinite power that allows the mages there to use the school and to use magic freely and easily and stuff that isn't in the rest of the world that's having a shortage of this power. So the government has sent some sketchy bitch in to go and look at to try and figure out how it works so they can make a new one. And it's like everything she does is so fucking sketchy and is very openly sketchy from the beginning. It's like anyone with a brain would be like, no, just no. So, like, the writing between all the interpersonal stuff, amazing. Their interactions with each other, so good. So humorous, so sweet. Overall lore takes a nosedive directly into the ground, which is kind of a shame, because I do like the concept of the world is interesting, but they just don't quite have the lore where it needs to be for it to make a bunch of sense. Any questions?
Right. Well, the only question I have is it's a $30 game. Is this something that people should be checking out?
If you liked the first one, this is very different. And if you liked it, I would say maybe this is a try it. I would not start on this one. I would definitely start on the first one. I think it's probably a decent buy it, but I would probably wait for like a 40-50% sale, honestly, because it's it's not a lot, and if you're really into the story, all the lore problems are just gonna bother you a lot. I think it's worth buying, but 40-50% off would be my suggestion.
All right. Now we gotta move on. Next up is Final Sentence, developed by Button Mash, published by Polden Publishing. Released April 9th on Steam for $9.99. Final Sentence is a battle royale typing game. Together with the other players, you find yourself in a hangar with a typewriter in front of you and a revolver loaded with a single bullet at your temple. Every mistake can be fatal. Only one will remain. D, Aki, both of you played this one. D, start us off. What is Final Sentence?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, it's a battle royale typing game, which means, yeah, at the end, only one person is going to win. So it supports, I think, up to 40 players currently. The description isn't entirely accurate. You get to make three mistakes within a paragraph before you trigger kind of the signature mechanic of the game, which is Russian roulette, in which they load a single bullet into a gun and then fire it. And so, and then every other, succeeding three mistakes, they load another bullet and fire it. So it is possible to be eliminated on the first bullet, but it just, the more mistakes you get, the higher chance it becomes. Until eventually, at the sixth bullet, it's guaranteed. I've heard it described as Mavis Beacon with a gun. Do you remember that that old typing, the typing game?
That's beautiful.
With the nice nice black lady, but now she has a gun. and is wearing a mask.
I'll and a trench coat. Kill you.
it's pretty fun. And you get a pretty good variety of prompts. There is technically a 4-minute timer. I've never reached the end of that, but theoretically, if you took four minutes to try and finish a paragraph, you would be eliminated because you're taking too long. But every time you finish a paragraph, you get time added. So usually I literally have not ever been eliminated that way. So
damn.
Showing that is off. What's that?
Said you're showing off.
I am a pianist, so.
No, yeah, true. Fair.
I don't like to brag, but so that's the main format, Battle Royale. It has a few other formats. Another one is Takedown, where you actually don't get punished for mistakes. You just get, at least not with roulette, you just have to wait for a certain amount of time. But the last person to finish the paragraph gets eliminated. And so everybody's just, it's just last one standing. Usually there's about, I want to say like five-ish paragraphs, but it kind of depends depending on the prompt. I think that's about it for the Takedown format. And then there's also the Duel format, which is one-on-one, obviously. And I think it's similar rules for, I think that one does have roulette, possibly. I don't remember. Sorry. I think it's mainly just the pause that is the punishment. And then you have a custom format where you can kind of tweak any of the settings. You can there's settings for like whether capitals matter. In the default Battle Royale format, they don't. And then whether you need to, press space or enter at the end of a line. You can, customize the prompts. You can choose whether roulette happens or not. You can tweak the AI difficulty. So that mode is good for custom games with your friends or practice or whatever. So there is no currently solo format, although I think that is planned for the future. So the custom mode would be the only way you could do a solo mode. And I think that's basically it for the game. It's pretty bare bones. And I think that there would be my main complaint is it feels a little bit unfinished at the moment.
Seems to be a common complaint people have of the game is that it's fun, but after so long, like, what else is there to do?
Right, exactly. And also the player population is not like super high at the moment. Like on any given game, I'll be with like maybe I think average maybe 5 or fewer actual players, and the rest are going to be bots, which is still decently fun. But when the bots are typing 30, 40 words per minute, and it's pretty easy for a decent typer to reach 100 or more words per minute, it's not a big challenge. I think that's where they could improve the most, or at least have some sort of difficulty selection when you're matchmaking, because you're either playing with 30, 40 words per minute, or you get blown up by somebody like a single person who's typing 160 words per minute. So
that's what Aki was telling me about. Aki, how was your time on this one?
I did pretty good. I got second in every game I played because fairly often a lot for some reason. Apparently, it was like you're definitely a gamer and a reviewer. So here's a whole bunch of stuff that has, IGN score this out of this. Here's a blurb about what this game's like. And I'm like, oh, god damn it. No, why me? And then I'd end up getting second because I was just, I'm really bad at getting to the numbers because I've just never excelled at doing numbers while I'm typing. And yeah, there was someone who was typing like another 10 or 15 words per minute faster than me. So it was always very noticeable that the person kept getting done much, much faster than me. I was like, you motherfucker, quit it. Everyone else is like, oh, they're taking another like 20 seconds before they're getting done. What the fuck? I guess I was going against a lot of bots. I didn't realize you played against bots. I played at least one round of every mode. My favorite one was was the one where you're typing against a bunch of people and whoever's the slowest gets eliminated. The second one you talked about, I forgot its name already. That's my favorite mode. I absolutely love that mode. I played that a whole bunch. The big one, I wasn't as much of a fan because I'd always screw up at least once in every paragraph, and it ends pretty quick when you're fucking up like that.
It's easy to get tilted.
Yeah. I surprisingly like this, and I don't mind that it's not a whole bunch of people because it means at some point I'm going to get first place. It may take me a while, but I'll eventually get it because I'll eventually hit a place where I'm the only human being playing it, and I can definitely beat the goddamn bots. Because as you said, the bots are they're very easy to beat. Thank fuck for that. I want easy wins too, okay? Fuck off.
That's fair. Well, let's talk about price on this one. It is a $10 game. What do you two think about it?
Go first. Okay. For $10, I don't know if I can recommend it. Like, I want to like it. It is fun, but for $10, I'm not sure. It's a good game for such a small team. The graphics are stylish. The gameplay is great. The atmosphere, I love the atmosphere, you know, the moody atmosphere. But like I said, it feels unfinished. I just really wish there was like a single player mode where you can, you know, improve your skills, you know, have some sort of progression. Like right now there's, I think there's literally like 7 achievements. And after that, there's nothing. You can increase your level. I'm like level 200 at this point, I think, but
it doesn't
mean anything. So, yeah, like you don't get anything. You don't get any, I think you can buy the supporter pack, which comes with cosmetics, but you can't, like, there's no way to earn them outside of that. So, but I think that the main thing that's hurting it the most is just the lack of player population. So it's hard to recommend at this stage. It's my final verdict.
That is fair. They do have a roadmap where they're looking ahead May. They're hoping to have skill-based matchmaking and friend visibility. And then in the future, they're looking at some kind of solo edition. So that might be addressed in the future. Aki, your thoughts?
I really want to recommend this because I thought it was fun too, and the atmosphere is very, you're sitting with a bunch of grammar Nazis, and they're shooting you if you get it wrong, and that's kind of funny to me. but like she said, there's not a lot here yet. I think if you're like, I really like typing games, this is, might as well get it now, and when they add stuff, it'll be great. I don't think they're probably going to increase the price as they add stuff to it, so if you want to wait, go for it, but I think it's a decently fun little game. I think it's worth buying. If you think it's a little too high-priced, wait for a little bit of a sale, like 10, 20%, whatever. So but I think it's totally worth getting.
Minimum wish list this thing?
Oh, yeah, for sure. This is, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, sounds good. D, that is it for you. Did you want to stick around to the end, or did you want to head out?
I'll stick around for a little bit.
Cool, because we got 3 more games to go. Next up is Before I Go, and before you go, you get to hear about Before I Go. And before I go, we get to talk about Before I Go. Well, Pernell will talk about. Developed and published by Jay's Laboratory, released April 13th on Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS5, and PC for $19.99. Explore the haunting, dreamlike fantasy world of Before I Go, a punishing Metroidvania where you embody the innocence of an inner child on an allegorical odyssey toward death acceptance. The end is inevitable, but will you brave the journey? Pernell, it sounds like after you and I were talking earlier, I need to put a lot of time into this game.
Well, it depends, because this game's hard as shit. You weren't typically one for challenging platformers, so you might want to rethink that.
Is this game?
So you kind of already described it, because the funny part is what you just described is more than what the game will pretty much give you for the most part, which is fine, because it's meant to be kind of a metaphor as you experience the adventure. But essentially, you play as a little child Wisp character who's exploring this very aggressive world, I'll call it. Everything looks angry, like scary, corrupted, I'll even say. That's a good way to put it. Viral and corrupted. And you very much stand out from everything else that exists in this place. And you come across the occasional NPC that'll say things to you like, come on, you got to do something about this. This is crazy. Everything's going to crap. So even before hearing your description, my take was, this is about somebody dying, isn't it? Though I guess the game title being Before I Go, the two things combined just kind of tells you. But nonetheless, that by no means is a bad thing, because this game is pretty cool. You have your basic kit. And what I mean by that is at the beginning of the game, literally the only thing you can do is jump. But as you progress and explore the environments, you gain a variety of different abilities. I'm not going to spoil what they are, but I will say just the obvious starting one is the ability to shoot and fight back against the enemies that exist on the map. You'll be able to acquire crystals, whether by killing enemies or by destroying objects that are, you know, kind of clipped onto the sides of the walls. And you can use those crystals to purchase upgrades for yourself once you get to the occasional, I guess, I can't remember what they're called, the extraction points or something. But essentially, they are different from the checkpoints you can also come across, which will save your progress in the event that you die. And they also fully heal you. But they also will allow you to upgrade your character. And you can also teleport between them when you were starting it, when you were at one of them. You have a health meter, and you also have a gauge that lets you use some of your special abilities that you gain as you progress through the game. And each of those things can be expanded upon by getting four, or basically the multiple of the MacGuffins that exist for them, energy and health, you know, specifically. The game also has a nice counter when you pause the game that tells you how many of them you found amongst the total that exists in the game. So for all the completionists out there, boom. You gain access to some sub-abilities as well that you can have equipped once you find them on the map, and then you can upgrade your character as you get stronger to equip more than one of them at a time, up to like four or so. The platforming in this game is pretty brutal, so you definitely want to make sure to get those health upgrades as soon as you can, because while I can't tell you exactly how I feel about it, because different strokes for different folks, so what my experience is may not be yours, but I can say that the game has some tough, challenging jumps early on, but with the right health upgrades, I would say it's very fair, and that you will likely not find yourself dying too often, because as long as you have the ability to learn from your mistakes and have good reaction times on certain situations. Later on in the game, though, so prepare yourself for that. Just know the game easy you win in a way that is much nicer than, say, something like Aeternus Noctis, which I've also reviewed for the show, and that game is brutal damn near from the beginning. This game is not that until later.
That's nice, because I played Aeternus Noctis, and man, that's tough from the get-go.
Yes, it starts mean and just becomes worse. Though I will say one thing that they both have in common is the more abilities you gain in the game, the more difficult the game gets. Like normally in a game, you start getting all these abilities and you feel so powerful. In this game, it's like, now that I have these abilities, I can do more difficult things. So, and not in the I'm capable of doing more difficult things, more like we made the game more difficult to accommodate those new abilities. So, ouch. But with that said, though, if you're in the family that likes that kind of gameplay, then you'll be in hog heaven here, because it's fun to explore. It's fun to fill out the map. The game gives you information that lets you know all the time how much of the game you completed, both in map completion and also item discovery. The only downside I have to the game is the fact that I wish there was more music and more variety to the music, because the tracks that exist in this game are, for the most part, a few scores that come along here and there that kind of loop once and then fade away for another track. And they're not exclusive to areas, at least not that I could tell. So I guess they might be composed. They might have been like contracted out. It might be from like a freeware site. I don't know. But ultimately, I wish there was more tracks. Though the tracks that are here do sound nice. Like I never found myself turning the audio down. I just wish there was more of it. So that may well be the only gripe I have. Also, I guess the general sense that the narrative is kind of pasted on for the excuse for you to move around this environment and explore more. Some people might want more than that. I don't particularly care as long as the experience and the gameplay is fun, but your mileage may vary in that on that front. But all in all, I think this game is a solid bet. If you like challenging platformers with the Metroidvania tagline to it, then you really can't lose here.
Very good. Clocks in at $20. Your official verdict.
Before I go, you should go to buy this game. And now I need to go because that pun was horrible.
Ha.
Yes, it was.
Yay.
The important part is I acknowledge my own sins.
Yeah. Next up, Ariana and the Elder Codex, developed by Idea Factory, compile Heart and Hide, published by Idea Factory International. Released March 24th, Switch, PS4, PS5, and PC for $29.99. Aki, we covered this one a couple of weeks ago. Purnell talked about it. We got an extra Steam key in for you to check this one out. What did you think of Ariana and the Elder Codex?
This is really fucking fun. I've played a game similar to this in the past. It didn't look this good or play this good, but I've played something similar in the past, and it was really nice. You went and go into the books, you fix them up, you get, you know, scores on it. This shit's fun, and it's not that hard to get a good score on it, which is just fantastic. I absolutely love it.
For the people who didn't hear it the first time around, give us a quick update or a quick wrap up of what the game is about, and then give us your thoughts on everything.
Okay, in this, you play a magical librarian in a magical world. Magic is given to the people via these books, and you're a librarian. Your job is to go into the books and repair them magically when they get damaged. And for some reason, someone has damaged them on purpose and left traps, i.e. monsters, to try and attack you when you go in and fix them. So you go in and fix them anyways, because fuck that person. And you bring magic back to the world! Stuff. There you go. It's real fun. You can unlock, you know, different magical abilities from each of the codexes. Well, each of the elemental ones anyways. As you see fit, there is enough in the stuff, resources in the game to unlock all the abilities, upgrade them all. Real nice. I haven't found many of the magical abilities to be as fun to actually play with. Like, it's interesting to see how they work, but there's a couple of them that are basically every element has the same abilities, more or less. It's just, this time it's with water, this time it's with fire. And there's just a certain couple of them that I really like more than the other, so those are what I use every time. I just change out what element it's for. And, yeah, it's a nice little fun game. I've thoroughly enjoyed the, you know, little bit of platforming in it. The combat's nice and quick and fun. I really like it.
Pernell, have you gotten any further in this one?
No, life moves fast, baby.
It does, man.
The heart moves fast.
It does.
But I do know that I like the game quite a bit. So someone might be hearing that and going,
because you checked it out on, what was it, PS5 or Switch? Did you check it out on PS5, I think?
PS5. And someone might be hearing me talking, going, well, if you like this so much, why haven't you finished it? And the answer is, I also like Clair Obscur. Ask me how far in that I've gotten.
I don't want to talk about that one either.
I still haven't beaten the boss that I got stuck on.
I need to go back to that one, too.
Yeah, sometimes some games you have you're able to get into, sometimes some games you aren't, and then you have the moments where you pick it up on a whim. It's like, this is the time where it all starts to shine, and now I'm making all my progress.
All right, homework. The three of us, all three of us have to play Clair Obscur this week.
I might be
even doable. If I play it, I'm still not going to be able to beat the fucking boss I'm stuck at, and right now
it's an optional boss. Go around it.
No, it isn't.
I could have sworn you were saying you weren't the optional boss.
Are you
it's the only boss I have access to, and I have to get through it to get to the next area.
What act are you on? If that's not a spoiler to say what act you're on.
I assume the first one. I'm in the underwater area you go to.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's early.
Yeah. I played it for like 2 days, got to this area, and that I haven't been able to beat this boss.
Drop the difficulty?
Yeah, drop the difficulty. That's a situation where you should just drop
it. I'm already on the easier difficulties.
YouTube, watch someone beat it and do what they did.
Yeah. Oh, I know what I'm doing wrong. I'm not able to deflect the attacks properly because I am not very
So anyway, good at Ariana that. And the Elder Codex is $29.99. We need a verdict on this one.
It's great. I'm totally for it. Enjoy yourselves, folks. It's a great game.
For now, any thoughts?
Oh, no, I just support the statement. I think it's a buy it in one of Idea Factory's best games in a long time.
Very good. I know Idea Factory has dabbled with some Xbox releases. I'm going to cross my fingers that they give this one a shot over there. If they're still open to attempting Xbox releases. I don't know if that's paid off for them or not, but I appreciate that they actually tried.
Yeah.
That was nice of them. Final game to talk about tonight is ZPF, developed by ZPF Team, published by Megacat Studios. It released April 16th on Steam for $9.99. ZPF is a retro-inspired horizontal shooter for the Genesis / Mega Drive. Blast your way through a cosmic gauntlet of epic boss battles, addictive scoring, and hidden secrets in a thrilling arcade-style adventure through fantasy, sci-fi, and alien-themed worlds. Cornell, what's ZPF?
ZPF is best described as a long-lost Sega Genesis shmup. Another way to describe it would be a long-lost Genesis shmup that feels like Lords of Thunder's, you know, long-lost brother. But the way this game works is that you are one of three ships, because if you asked me what the story was, I couldn't fucking tell you. But you're one of three ships that you choose at the beginning of each level, and you are blasting your way through beautiful stages with a solid score of music. Each of these ships plays very differently. More so, I guess, in the sense that they each have their own unique shot type and their own unique melee type. Melee type being the close combat attack that they do. And the, you know, bullets are different. Like, for example, my favorite character is like the knight character. And he's also the reference that I use between him and the shop between levels that reminds me heavily of Lords of Thunder. He flies around. He shoots a wave of swords when you use your shot button. And if you do your melee, he does like a really strong forward shot attack. His bullets are not the strongest, but his melee attack is really good. So if you want to get up close and personal, he's your guy. Enemies come in waves. When you defeat them, they drop currency, which you thankfully don't have to pick up. It immediately falls to your character window at the bottom of the screen. However, if power-ups are dropped, you do need to pick those up manually in order to reap their benefits, increasing the power of your shots and such. And also occasionally getting, you know, additional bombs if you start using your bombs up. Every once in a while, as you run through levels, you might luck out and find a hidden item on the stage. It might come back to help you later at the end of the game. So look for those if you can. At the end of each level is a pretty cool boss. Some easy, some not. But when you clear the stage, you will get a wrap-up of points, your currency, and then you can choose another stage. And at certain intervals, new levels will open up until you get to the very end of the game. The items you can buy in the shops are things that even relate to like getting more, purchasing more points, getting continues, shot power-ups, a variety of nice little things, continues just to keep your game moving and keep you moving. And obviously the game is designed in such a way where you don't need the items in the shop so that you can spend your money on points. Yeah. So the game is very much meant to be something where score chasers need apply because they want you to chase that great point high and meet the high scoreboards. It's hard to go into a lot of detail about how to describe this game because there's not a ton to it, not making it a bad thing. In fact, that makes it a great thing. It's a very straightforward shmup that is very beautiful with a nice audio style track. If you're a fan of Sega Genesis, Yamaha sound chip that's on that Mamma Jamma, you'll be right at home here. They did a banger of a job composing music for this game. But it's like with most shmups, like, you know what you're getting into when you play them. You're going in, you're shooting things, you're not dying, you're collecting points and money and shopping and progressing to the end of the game. And then you do it all over again with a different set of ships, more so if you don't get the ending you wanted. This game has multiple endings, so suck on that. All in all, I had been curious about this. I played a little bit of the demo at PAX, maybe, it feels like 2 years ago. But it may have been last year. I'm old and forgetful. But the point is, I played it at PAX. PAX at MAGFest. Thought it was a good time. Was looking forward to the final game. I know people are like, PAX, the fuck are you talking about? Though it might have been in PAX, too. I don't know. I haven't been to PAX in years. But I have been to MAG. It wasn't MAG. I liked it at MAG. I like it on my Steam Deck. And I think you'll like it, too. Pick this Mamma Jamma up. If you like Lords of Thunder, this is a no-freaking-brainer. If you like classic shmups, this is a no-freaking-brainer. If you like games, this is a no-brainer. Anyway, let's get to the final question, which I kind of answered, but I'll answer it definitively.
Yeah, you kind of did answer. It's $10. Verdict.
Easy buy it recommendation. You can't go wrong, especially for that price.
Sounds good.
Especially with that Yamaha sound chip.
And with that, we are finished with this episode. Big thanks again to Artem and Oleg from Sneg for coming on in the first half of the show. Big thanks to Horacolyte for coming on, hanging out for that part as well. Very
thank you,
big
Horacolyte, having... for coming on and recommending an expensive game for me.
D, thank you for being here, hanging out with us. Music this episode, we're going to play something from you. So what should we play to end the show?
I'm me?
No, not you, Purnell. D shoot.
I'm going to go with my cover of Eight Melodies from Earth. Well, Mother, or Earthbound Zero, as it's known on Switch Online. And it's called Power Than Glory because in the vocal album, one of the lyrics is Love is the Power and Love is the Glory. So that's why it's called that. Very good.
Did you know there's a better Earthbound project than the Psychokinetic album?
That no has many way.
Of the same people. That has many of the same people, but it's totally better and not older.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's called Bound Together. I'm
definitely not on that one either.
I've never talked about it on this show before, ever. Go to joecam.net and you could find it. Again, that is it for this episode. We will be playing The Power and the Glory to wind everything up. Does anybody have any final words to end the show?
Her song title are the perfect words to end the show.
The Power and the Glory.
That's right. Yeah. Not bad. Put that in your pipe and smoke
it. I did. I just sang it. Is that not good enough for you, Purnell?
Sing it again. Oh.
Everybody at the same time. One, two, three. The power of the
glory. La, 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 la.
That was a train wreck. Thank you.